can remain standing for the reading of the gospel today. It's the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to St. Luke.
Glory to you, Lord Christ.
In the days of Herod, king of Judah, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah. And he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord, but they had no child because Elizabeth was barren, and both were advanced in years. Now while he was serving as priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense, and there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. You shall call his name John, and you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great before the Lord, and he must not drink wine or strong drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God, and he will go before him in the spirit and the power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared." Zechariah said to the angel, "How shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife is advanced in years." The angel answered him, "I am Gabriel, and I stand in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. Behold, you will be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time." The people were waiting for Zechariah, and they were wondering at his delay in the temple. When he came out, he was unable to speak to them, and they realized that he had seen a vision in the temple, and he kept making signs to them and remaining mute. And when his time of service was ended, he went to his home. Pick up the reading in verse 57. Now the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son. Her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. And on the eighth day they came to circumcise the child, and they would have called him Zechariah after his father, but his mother answered, "No, he shall be called John." They said to her, "None of your relatives is called that name." And they made signs to his father, inquiring what he wanted him to be called. And he asked for a writing tablet and wrote, "His name is John." And they all wondered. And immediately his mouth was opened and his tongue loosed, and he spoke, blessing God. Fear came on all their neighbors, and all these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea, and all who heard them laid them up in their hearts, saying, "What then will this child be? For the hand of the Lord was with him." This is the gospel of the Lord.
Glory to you, Lord Christ.
You can be seated. Make yourself comfy for a bit. I think this is just a fascinating story, and actually a really beautiful one, but one that has to it for us today a very prophetic quality, in that it has, I think, things for us to hear in it today. It's an old story, and God was doing things and saying things to Zechariah and Elizabeth, but to those around them, to the nation, through this story. I think he has still things to say to us today. Really quickly, let me just recap the story that I've just read from the Gospel of Luke. We get introduced to a man who isn't known until in the scriptures until this moment, and then we don't hear much of him again. His name is Zechariah, and Zechariah was a priest. He was a man who worked in the temple. And at this time, if you go back into, even if you looked at 1 Chronicles chapter 24, you'll see how the priests were ordered. The priests in the Aaronic priesthood were ordered. They were actually divided up into 24 groups. And each of those groups would serve in the temple for 2 weeks a year, 1 week at a time. And so between the lot of them, there would always be priests there to serve the duties needed in the temple for temple worship. So 24, and they would be there twice, that's 48. But then they also all had to come, all 24 divisions came for major festivals, especially like the Passover, where during the Passover, they would sacrifice over 100,000 animals. So you needed a lot of priests on duty. And so they would all be called in for these major feast days. But then throughout the regular year, they would take their turns. And as we get to this story, Zechariah is in his week. So Zechariah is at the temple with his division. The divisions weren't just kind of set up arbitrarily. They were family divisions. He came from this household. And so he was part of this household. And as a good priest, but actually as in some ways what would have been actually vetted and figured out in his marriage, Elizabeth too comes from the Aaronic line. Priests who grew up into that line and were going to act as priests didn't just marry anyone. They married people. They kind of made sure that this couple together would be able to stand in a place and represent to the people of God this priestly ministry. And so Elizabeth, too, is a daughter of Aaron, it's said. And that's a significant statement. It goes on, though, further to say that Zechariah and Elizabeth are not just priest and daughter of Aaron, but they are actually, even in and of themselves and in the life they're leading, righteous before God, it says, and walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. So not only is Zechariah a priest, he's a good one. And he's not just a good one because he can pull off priestly duties, which maybe some others were doing, but he was a good one in the ways that mattered. This was a godly man. One of the words that would get used to describe Zechariah, you may or may not be familiar with, it would be a word pious. This was a pious man, a righteous man, a holy man, a man after God's heart. Zechariah is chosen by lot, it says, out of the group of his division, which would have been quite a large group of priests, to tend to the incense at the altar of incense in the temple during this day of worship. This would have most likely been for Zechariah a once-in-a-lifetime deal. It would have been a massive honor. And to serve where he is about to serve in the story that we're reading would have been in some ways a high point in his vocational life. He would have been so excited, and as a righteous and devout man, not just for wrong reasons. This is a holy place to be, to serve at the altar of incense. And so Zechariah goes in to carry out these duties on a day that I can only imagine putting myself in his shoes, he's quite excited about, for really good reasons. And there in this day where he goes in probably with all kinds of expectations, Zechariah has probably the most incredible encounter with God he's ever going to have. He might have expected this to be quite a holy day. He might have expected that this would be a game changer kind of day for him, but I don't think he expected it to look like it did. So Zechariah goes into the altar of incense and he's carrying out his duties when an angel of the Lord, who later explains to Zechariah, I serve in the courts of the Lord. I actually serve right beside him. I've come to you from heaven. From the invisible, I have come into the visible. So Zechariah is rightly immediately afraid until the angel tells him not to be. And I always have to ask myself this question of him. Later in the Advent narratives, you've got the shepherds. Right after Jesus' birth, angels appear to them. They're afraid. Mary is afraid. I always wonder if after the angel says to these people, don't be afraid, if they're still afraid. They never say, but I'm thinking, okay, like, maybe I at least kind of pull myself together a little, but I think he's still in a place of reverence for sure. Holy fear, I don't think, could possibly leave him. And so he's standing there with this angel, and the angel begins to speak into Zechariah's life personally, and not just into his life, but into a very, very tender place of his life. Into a place where Zechariah has probably come to some level of peace in his old age, a place of barrenness. Now, one of the commentators that I read was saying that where it is said of Zechariah and Elizabeth that they were righteous before God and followed all the commandments, it immediately then says, but they were barren. And part of the reason why the text combines these two things is that in their community, it would have been probably seen or thought of them that though they were pious people, that piety had gone unrewarded. that in a Jewish context, to not have children would have been very quickly connected to the fact that look at these great holy people, and it's completely unrewarded by the Lord because they have no children. And so this is a deeply sensitive place. It is for any of us who can't have children. Jen and I understand this place. And so I sit there with Zachary and I think that's a tough place to be. But one he's probably, and it seems, has come to some resolution with. He's too old to have children. And so is his wife. But the angel says, I've come from heaven to tell you that your prayers have been heard and you're going to have a son. And then he begins to prophesy the most amazing things about this son. Amazing. He'll operate in the power of Elijah. He'll be filled with the Holy Spirit from the womb. He, like, exciting stuff. So you've got to put yourself in the picture. Zechariah is in the greatest day of his priestly life by the incense, altar of incense, burning incense to heaven, and heaven visibly responds. And then what comes out of heaven's mouth is, we heard your prayers, and they're going to be answered. And they're not just kind of going to be answered. We're going to take the things you prayed for, and we're going to do with them more than you ever could have thought or imagined. In that picture, in that space, I think we have a pretty clear picture of Zechariah's heart when we see his response. Zechariah responds, and it can be a bit confusing because Zechariah's response, simply the way it's written, what we hear him say doesn't seem that off. What he asks is a pretty understandable question. How could this be? I'm pretty old, and so is my wife, right? Now, he's not in trouble because he called his wife old. That can get you in trouble, but God doesn't mind that. He realizes, you're right. She is of age, but then he says, I am going to shut your mouth. You will be mute because you didn't believe me. So there's consequence to these words that come out of Zechariah. What's confusing about it is if you keep reading in Luke, the next story in between the two parts I read is Mary's story, where the angel comes to Mary and tells her, you're going to have a son. Mary does a very similar thing. She says to God, how could this be? I'm a virgin. And the Lord just continues to bless her and to explain and to answer and love her. So it can be a bit confusing what's going on here. And it points to me to the fact that there's something going on in Zechariah's heart that we don't read in his words and we might miss, but heaven doesn't. Zechariah doesn't believe him. Mary's got a valid question. Zechariah has disbelief. And the angel says, I came to you from the throne of heaven with these prophetic words in this holy moment, and you've not believed me. I'm going to shut your mouth. Zechariah immediately can't speak. The angel carries on. He is, I'm imagining, quite humbled in this moment. But what's interesting is that in this great day of his priestly ministry, Zechariah is literally not able to finish his priestly duties. Because Zechariah, it says all the people were waiting for him. The reason they're waiting for him is he would have come out from that altar and declared the benediction. And he can't do it because his mouth doesn't work. So Zechariah comes out and it says he's making signs. So he's probably trying to say, I can't speak. But he's also trying probably to explain that I can't give the benediction. Like, I don't really know where we go from here. I'm going to need somebody else to do that. Like, there's this kind of whole craziness happening. And this is the kind of the end of his great day of priestly ministry. This was going to be a gooder, right? And now he can't even finish what he was supposed to do. He's been, in a way, and this is the language that keeps coming to me over these days and many of the places we've been as a community. I think this very much, in a very real way, would have brought Zechariah to his knees. Zechariah, humbled, unable to speak, contemplating now these things in his heart because he can't contemplate them with his mouth, goes home, and sure enough, Elizabeth conceives. She's pregnant. Miracle. What the angel said is true. But still, he remains mute. And through the entire pregnancy, can't speak. As he walks through that, the Lord begins to work in his heart. And then we see this incredible moment. If you pick it up in verse 56, I think, or 57, it tells of the birth of John the Baptist. And after he's been born and the community is celebrating this incredible miracle, on the eighth day they take him to be circumcised, which was the custom of the Jewish people. And at that custom, they would have named him. So it's time to name him. Well, the Jewish people had a lot of customs, and one of them was that that name was not just random. They didn't get the baby book like we do, right? Or try and come up with something really creative that no one else possibly could have thought of. This boy's name, the answer was almost rhetorical, it seems. It should have been what? Zechariah. But Elizabeth stops them before they follow through on this and says, nope, his name is John. And they look at her like a couple things are happening. First of all, we're not sure what to do because you as the wife shouldn't be answering this question. Right? And we can't read some of our Western, like our today, into this. This was just the ordering of things, the way it happened. The father named the son. But he can't because his voice doesn't work. So Elizabeth says, his name will be John. Well, these guys all look at each other like, well, it shouldn't be John, it should be Zechariah. And do we even supposed to listen to her? Like, what do we do with this? And so they turn to Zechariah and say, like, what do you want us to do? He asks for a writing tablet, and he writes on that tablet what is, I think, now reflective of a very different heart than we saw earlier in the story. This man has been brought to his knees, surrendered to the plans and the actions of God. And it's witnessed when he writes, his name is John. And you know why I think that? Because immediately his mouth opens. Something that the Lord started 9 months ago has been brought to its fullness, has been brought to some sense of completion. He's been brought to a low place, to a place of surrender to the will of God. And as he confesses that by naming his son John, his mouth is opened and he begins to prophesy over his nation, to prophesy over his son, to begin to out of the silence comes the most beautiful prophetic song, this prophetic voice. It's an incredible story. But for us today, I want us to take a little bit of a closer look at what exactly is going on here, because I think there's some things we should consider. I'm going to look at it a little bit myself, but I want to look too at something that Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote. I printed out a couple copies of it in its long form. If any of you really wanted to kind of read it, you're welcome to take one. Zechariah was a pious, holy man. You can imagine how this day would have been for him when he woke up. And you can imagine how this day would have been for him when his mouth was shut. God chooses the most incredible moment in Zechariah's life to bring him to his knees. When Zechariah is, in many eyes, at his pinnacle, the Lord chooses to bring him to his knees. That's allowed to bother us. That's allowed to make us step back and go, what is happening here? Why is God doing this to Zechariah? And why would he choose today, of all days, to do it? It seems actually a little bit off-putting to me. It seems a little bit unfair. Maybe there's even parts of our hearts that would feel like it's a little cruel. Why might a pious man like Zechariah need to be brought to his knees? And why so publicly? Why on this day of all days? It's an important question. And in answer to it, I would suggest this. That piety, our righteousness, is a place ripe with the potential for pride. That the place of our greatest extraordinariness, the place where we are most brilliant, or walking out even great things of righteousness and holiness and calling, are ripe, like a minefield in some ways, with self-righteousness and pride. Jesus knew this well. He at one point speaks in this thing about humility, which is something we're talking a lot about as a community right now, when he talks about a tax collector and priest who go to pray. And the priest is all proud of himself because he's like, look how I pray. I'm so good at this. He's so up in front and in people's faces with the whole situation. He thinks this is amazing. And then there's this tax collector in the back who kind of comes down into himself, and posture probably reflects better a place of prayer. And he just begins to pray to God from an honest place where he needs, there's this humility in him. And Jesus uses it to speak into the life of these pious individuals like Pharisees and scribes. So this is something that kind of keeps coming up in the Gospels, in the lives of those who walk in a place of piety. Be careful. And Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, if you look at Matthew chapter 6, and this is where we'll spend a little time with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus starts off the second chapter of the Sermon on the Mount by saying this: beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you will have no reward from your Father who's in heaven. It's interesting, and this is where Bonhoeffer helped me out. If you read chapter 5 of the Sermon on the Mount, it's like the Beatitudes, and there's kind of some moral and ethical things we're called to, love your neighbor, this way of extraordinary righteousness. And he says literally in it, you're like salt and light. You're to let it shine before men. And then in the second chapter of the Sermon on the Mount, he starts by saying, after he said, let it shine before men, be careful to let it shine before men, that you might be seen. Jesus calls us to righteousness, but then right in the very next step says, just be careful in your righteousness. There's like this really strong caution brought into this most holy place. Let me read for you this quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It'll be on the screen, and it's in the printout that I've got there if you want to read it slower later. The call to be extraordinary is the great and inevitable danger of discipleship. So in the fifth chapter, what Dietrich's saying is we've been called to be extraordinary. The kinds of people who would love our neighbors. The kinds of people who are poor in spirit. The kinds of people who live in these incredibly beautiful, righteous ways. An extraordinary way. But Bonhoeffer says, in it is an inevitable danger. Therefore, beware of this extraordinariness. That's a word I think he made up. I can hardly say it. Of the way that discipleship becomes visible. Jesus calls a halt to our thoughtless, unbroken, simple joy in what is visible. He gives a sting to the extraordinary. Jesus calls us to reflection. The disciples should have this extraordinariness only by way of reflection. They should heed it. Watch out for it. The extraordinary is not supposed to happen in order to be seen. This means that the extraordinary deed should not be done for the sake of its being extraordinary. Pause for a moment just to give one quick example. Humility. We've been talking about it, right? What he's saying here is simply something like this. Humility should not be sought so that people see you're humble. It should not be lived into or done for the sake of itself. That humility is not about Jared being humble so everyone can see that Jared's humble and think, isn't that so amazing, Jared's humble. And it should not be seen just for the sake of being seen, but the better righteousness of the disciple should be an end in itself. Of course, what is extraordinary does have to become visible. It does have to happen, but beware you do not do it in order for it to become visible. Although the visibility of discipleship does have a necessary reason, which is the call of Jesus Christ, it's never the goal in and of itself. And so Dietrich helps us by using this language of visible and hidden. And he speaks of the fact that there is a visible quality to our righteousness, to us living in the way of Jesus. And we talk about this lots. That as we live in the way of Jesus, the world around us sees Jesus in us, and that has an impact on the world around us. And that's a right and beautiful thing. It's part of the fruit of the life of discipleship. But Dietrich wants us to understand, too, that it's important. Jesus is trying to show us that you, at the same time, that righteousness needs to be hidden. Now, it seems a bit confusing. I was thinking, this sounds a little bit like if I asked you to, I don't know if you've ever had anyone do this, if I asked you to stop thinking about the number 13 and then to let me know when you've done it. Right? It kind of seems like on first read, it feels like that. And that's what Bonhoeffer's trying to say. He's the Sermon on the Mount kind of feels like that. It's like, I want you to let your works shine before men, but make sure they're hidden, like it's hidden. What? Like, this seems impossible. What are you trying to do to us? Give us brain aneurysms as disciples of Jesus? Like, this is not fun. But that's not at all what's happening here. It's not at all what Jesus was trying to do in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, what Jesus was trying to do was to speak life and freedom into us as his disciples. Bonhoeffer, too, then, is simply trying to do what the angel was trying to do with Zechariah when he shut his mouth for 9 months. He's trying to address his heart. He's not trying to make some kind of convoluted minefield in which to be humble becomes this like super like confusing thing. I don't know if I should do it or if I shouldn't do it or if I do it, did I do it? Like, it's not trying to create that kind of environment. What he's trying to do is speak to and call out this part of us that in our hearts would want to be humble so that everyone in the room knows we're humble. He's wanting to address the places of our hearts that are susceptible to self-righteousness and pride, even in the places of our calling and our holiness. That we're called to discipleship to be like Jesus. And if you read Philippians chapter 2, which we don't have time to read together today, but go and read Philippians 2 verses 1 through 11. Let this mind also be in you, which was in Christ Jesus, though who he was by the very nature God, emptied himself, became a man, humbled himself even to the point of death, and not even just any death, the most humiliating, shameful death of the cross. And all this for the joy that was set before him. How do we do this? How do we live into this in a right way? As God calls us to humility, even as a church, and we look at who we are and we get excited about what God's doing and about what he would be starting here. How do we lean into these things and let our light shine before men, but to do it with humility? Bonhoeffer would suggest that it's very simple. I had a lot of other quotes, but I'm not going to go into them for the sake of time. Grab that paper and read it if you want to read it. But the gist of it is this. He says the only way you're going to be able to do this is if, as a disciple, you put your eyes firmly and only on Jesus. That to us, though our righteousness is visible to the world around us, it is as if hidden to us because all I can see is Jesus. That if you see righteousness in me, I am firmly convinced and know at the core of who I am, what you're actually seeing is Jesus. And that any righteousness you see in me is merely a reflection of my Creator. The disciple of Jesus has emptied himself to the point at which humility has become the mark of their lives. And it is, as Chris was saying earlier, it is just a right view of the truth. That the only place that we see rightly righteousness is when we look at Jesus. And there, it is not self-righteousness. It is just as it is. And so for us, we then as disciples live not out of our own righteousness, but out of his. And so we live a reflection of him. And the more that we understand this language that Dietrich uses, I think the better off we're going to be as we begin to press into the places where Jesus is rightly taking us and rightly calling us, asking us to be his hands and his feet, asking us to share the gospel and to exemplify to the world around us Christ-likeness, to take a good news, but to do it in a way that we won't get in the way come time. Why would Jesus have done this to Zechariah? Zechariah needed to be brought to his knees. But think about this for a minute. Do you think Zechariah thought he needed to be brought to his knees? Probably not. At least not to the extent at which God did. I don't think Zechariah saw this coming. Why would Jesus do this? Is there parts of my own heart, my own life, as a Christian, as a disciple, as I walk out this journey connected to my calling and my dreams and the things that I see God doing, as I try to walk in a Christ-like way, are there parts of me that need rightly to be brought to their knees? The reality of it is, if God hadn't brought Zechariah to his knees that day, I don't think Zechariah could have been the father he needed to be for John the Baptist. He probably couldn't have even named him right. But from the moment he declares his name and then begins to rearticulate the prophecies of heaven, he's not only in that time come to receive the fact that he would have a son, he's come to receive the full of the angel's promise. That this son would walk in the power of Elijah. That he would have the Holy Spirit in him. So Zechariah is the kind of dad who can release his son into the kind of ministry that John the Baptist did. And if you go and read the John the Baptist ministry, it's not the kind of thing most of our parents dream for us when we're born. You'd eat wild locusts and not cut his beard and live. You're like, this guy was, right? You read it in retrospect, you're like, yeah, he was awesome. But as his dad when he starts? But Zechariah knew. And it was deep. And he was submitted as a father to the plans and the will of God. So he continued to live a righteous and pious life, but parts of his heart had become hardened. And we see that when he can't receive the promise. So the Lord brings him back to a place where he can receive the promise and the full of it in order to live in humility. Our piety can be for us a place of real risk, a dangerous place. If we don't consistently fix our eyes on Jesus and remember that any of my righteousness is only a reflection of his. And this all is really just a matter of the heart. We can say the right things, do the right things, and at times we can even be totally unaware of the parts of our hearts that need to be brought to their knees. So maybe today in this Advent season, as we prepare our hearts to receive Jesus and to move forward together, we would take a moment to quietly pray. And after we've had some time of quiet prayer, Sarah's going to come and lead us together corporately in prayer. Because I want us to do this as individuals, but I want us to do this as a church. I think that God is calling us to this across via. Beginnings of something that God is doing and that we're very excited about, has touched many of our lives in deep ways, is really beautiful and of God. There might be parts of our hearts that need to be brought to their knees in order that as this story goes, we don't get in the way. That as this story goes, we remain those who simply and only reflect what God is doing. And in that way, God alone gets the glory. God alone becomes Savior, healer, object of worship, affection, attention. What does Zechariah's story speak to your own today? What does God's action in Zechariah's life do to your heart? Might as well ask the obvious question even already today. Lord, are there ways in which my own piety has become a source of pride for me? My calling, my experience, my gifting, what I've done, what I've got in my heart to do. Is God trying to bring me to my knees? Is he allowed? Pray for you, and then we'll take a moment of quiet prayer before Sarah comes. Lord, I thank you for Zechariah. thank you for the testimony of his life. And as I look at his story, I'm reminded that I have a story. I'm reminded that each one here has a story, that they're on a journey with you. God, would you come by your Spirit in this season, and would you speak in really beautiful ways, in needed ways, maybe in hard ways, to the parts of our lives that have in this way lost the plot. Where even the fruit of your hand has become a matter of boast for us. A matter of pride for us. Lord, would you speak to us right now? Would you help us to see, God, we don't want to even come up with things on our own, but by your Spirit, Lord, would you speak? Are there parts of our hearts and our lives, places of calling, of righteousness, where we need to be humbled, where we need to come into a right view of Jesus? Speak, Lord, I pray.